From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. In the little town of Lovell, Wyoming, one of the town's leading citizens was actually the town's leading criminal, a doctor who, over a period of years, was systematically raping his female patients. The story on today's Fresh Air from Jack Olson. He's written more than 20 books chronicling real-life crimes. Also today, writer Alan Gerganus gives us a preview of his upcoming novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews more previously unreleased Duke Ellington music. And among all the TV specials this week honoring the 20th anniversary of the moon landing, television critic David Bianculli picks his favorite. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. A test copy of the half-billion-dollar stealth bomber flew today for the first time. The evil-looking flying wing soared for 2 hours above the California desert in a flight designed to win congressional support for the controversial weapon. The B-2 is designed to evade enemy radar, so the test plane was covered with reflective material to allow tracking by test personnel. Test pilot Bruce Hines said he was very pleased with the jet's performance. Poland today became the first Warsaw Pact country to reestablish full diplomatic ties with the Vatican. The move comes 2 months after Poland's parliament granted legal status to the Roman Catholic Church. Jane Dobia has details.
Diplomatic ties between the Vatican and Poland have been set at the level of ambassador. The last ambassador from the Vatican left Warsaw in 1939 at the outbreak of World War II. When the communists came to power in 1945, they tried to suppress the Roman Catholic Church. Its property was confiscated and priests were arrested. But in recent years, the church has played an important political role in Poland. It offered haven to activists from the outlawed Solidarity Trade Union after martial law was declared in 1981. Earlier this year, church authorities were instrumental in arranging roundtable negotiations between the government and Solidarity. In a statement today, Catholic bishops in Poland said they were convinced that good relations with the Vatican will help protect citizens' rights and open a new field of activities that will benefit all of society. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Argentina's new Peronist government today signed an accord with hundreds of business leaders. The pact allows a failed attempt by President Carlos Menem's government to roll back prices that have more than doubled this month. David Wellner reports from Buenos Aires.
Under the terms of today's agreement, some 300 business leaders agreed not to raise their prices for the next 3 months. For its part, the government has pledged not to change the exchange rate for local currency, nor raise public utility rates for the same period of time. Officials admit that the prices of some products may still go up, but they hope the overall effect of the accord will be to break the inflationary spiral by creating expectations of price stability. Despite the virtual price freeze, the government has authorized new rounds of collective bargaining by the powerful Peronist trade unions to compensate for this month's enormous price hikes. The unions contend that businesses have set their prices high enough to absorb more labor costs without passing them on to consumers. For National Public Radio, I'm David Wellner in Buenos Aires.
President Bush today pledged his support for reform in Eastern Europe. He also said he would try to continue to improve relations with the Soviet Union. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 5 points. It closed the day at 2538.32. Advances led declines on volume of 154 million shares. This is NPR in Washington. The Soviet coal strike today spread to the largest coal field in the Ukraine. Soviet television said 8 mines in the Donbass coal field were on strike, with workers making demands similar to those issued by miners taking part in a week-old stoppage in the Siberian Kuzbass coal fields. Workers say they want greater say in decisions governing the mines. Representatives from the United Mine Workers Union and the Pittston Coal Group will meet with a federal judge in Duffield, Virginia tomorrow in an effort to find a way to resume stalled contract talks. Chris Roberts of member station WVTF has more.
Last Thursday, federal judge Glenn Williams invited both Pittston and the union to join him for a closed-door meeting to discuss the issues involved in the 4.5-month strike. Williams, who has levied hefty fines against the union for clogging coal traffic in southwest Virginia, said he wanted to gain a better understanding of why the two sides have not resumed contract talks. Federally mediated negotiations broke off June 7th when UMW President Richard Trumka accused Pittston of bad faith bargaining. Upon receiving Williams' invitation late last week, Trumka immediately accepted the offer and has since confirmed that he will send somebody to the meeting. Pittston spokesperson Susan Copeland says company president Mike Odom will be representing Pittston at the meeting, but she emphasized that the discussions will in no way be related to contract talks. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Roberts in Roanoke.
The American Cancer Society said today poor people have been deprived of benefits of improved therapies for treating cancer. Cancer Society President Harold Freeman said that for 37 million Americans who do not have health insurance and do not qualify for Medicaid, a cancer diagnosis usually comes when the disease has advanced to a stage where little can be done except control the pain. The Cancer Society estimates that 178,000 people with cancer who might have been saved through early diagnosis will die this year. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Detroit Free Press has called my guest Jack Olson the master of true crime. In his many books about sensational crimes, Olson has explored the mind of the psychopath and the effects of these crimes on families and communities. His books include Give a Boy a Gun and Son, a Psychopath and His Victims. Olson's newest book is Doc, The Rape of the Town of Lovell. Doc is Dr. John Story, the family doctor in a small Wyoming town. In 1985, Story was convicted of raping and assaulting several of his patients. As the story unfolded during his trial, it came out that he may have raped as many as 200 female patients during the 25 years he practiced medicine in Lovell. The revelations about Dr. Story tore the town of Lovell apart. He was one of the most respected citizens, the revered family doctor who had saved the lives of many of the town's residents. It was hard for many people to accept what had been going on behind the closed doors of Dr. Story's examining room. Jack Olson found that Dr. Story performed as many as 8 or 9 pelvic exams a day on female patients. He would recommend pelvic exams for all kinds of medical complaints, such as colds and headaches. It was during these pelvic exams that he committed all kinds of assaults on these women.
He raped patients in his examining room. He fondled patients. He did peculiar things like sometimes exposing himself or coming around to the side of the table and inserting himself between the patient's naked body and the table. Don't ask me what that means, but he did it apparently in several cases. But primarily, he was guilty of what you might call surreptitious entry during pelvic exams, when he would have the woman lying on her back, expecting to be poked and probed anyway, and wishing she were anywhere but there, like most women when they're getting a pelvic. He'd either just flat out do it, or if he felt there might be a problem, he would say, "Well, I'm having trouble seeing what I need to see. I'm going to have to dilate you." Or he would say, "I have to use the tube." Those were kind of the key phrases that told what he was really up to.
Many of the women talked about him saying to them before the examination, "My, but you look pretty today." A kind of, a friendly flirtation, which I guess from a doctor could be just a nice thing to say. But many of them also report that during the examinations, he was trying to hurt them, or they were hurt.
There isn't any question that he was sadistic about it. You can imagine far beyond what I wrote in my book, because I underplayed everything. It was a horrible enough story as it was, but he was very clearly enjoying hurting people. Women would go to Dr. Story for a pelvic, women that had been going to him since infancy and knew no other doctor. And they would go home after the pelvic and not be able to have normal sex with their husbands for 2 or 3 weeks. There are women in Lovell today who still find sex painful, not because of his pelvics, but because of the way he sewed them up after deliveries. Let your mind wander about what that means. Maybe it was just accidental. But there's a whole pattern of inflicting pain, women just in excruciating pain, because they didn't know that a pelvic isn't supposed to hurt.
You mentioned this before, but the position that a woman is in during a pelvic examination, I think it is one of the more vulnerable positions that women feel. And the doctor, I guess because a woman is flat on her back with her feet in the stirrups, a doctor can get a sense of their own omnipotence. Surely she cannot go anywhere. Was he interested in really that power position over women?
I think that's almost entirely what he was interested in. First of all, Dr. Story did not like Mormons. His residency was spent in Utah, where he encountered Mormons for the first time, and I confirmed this with his wife and other people. He came home frothing at the mouth about Mormon doctrine. He himself was an extremely conservative Bible Christian who founded his own church because the Baptist church was too liberal for him. And now winds up in this little town of Lovell, which was more than half Mormon. More than half his patients were Mormon. And so he couldn't come out and publicly assault the Mormons. And I think that he developed this technique of getting even with the Mormons, whom he despised, by raping their women.
Now, he didn't do this to all his female patients. How did he pick and choose, I suppose?
He picked and chose very carefully. He picked vulnerable women. He picked women whose marriages were in trouble. He picked women whose husbands were wimps. He picked women who were alone. He picked retarded women in some cases, going down to a retarded child, a woman who was involved in a butane inhalation thing and almost died and had temporary brain damage. He raped her soon after that. Any woman that he felt was very, very shy, which most of the Mormon women are. They certainly don't talk about sex. On the other hand, conversely, he would be very scrupulous in his attention to the undersheriff's wife, the state senator's wife, the mayor's wife, power figures. And as a result, when this all came out, those were the people who jumped in and said, Dr. Story could not have done this. I can tell you from my own experience that he, you know, et cetera.
Why did certain women continue to come back to see him over time, knowing how painful these examinations were, knowing that many of them felt very strange afterward, felt that they had been violated in some kind of way but didn't completely understand it? Why come back to a doctor who's going to hurt you?
Well, that's three or four different things. The women who realized what he was doing, in some cases they actually saw him. In most cases they didn't. When they realized what he was doing, for the most part, they left. And they did not come back. And in many cases, they reported him, although nothing came of it. Those who allowed him to inflict this pain over and over again were the women who didn't know any better. They thought this is what a pelvic was. You go in and you, et cetera, et cetera. And it hurts.
I'm speaking today with Jack Olson. His book is called Doc, The Rape of the Town of Lovell, and it's published by Athenaeum. You talked to a female, I believe she was a detective, Judy Cashel, and she was working on this case, and she said about the women of Lovell, Wyoming, that they were shy and naive and, quote, the 20th century had passed them by. She seemed to talk about a real, what we might call sexual illiteracy, that many women didn't know, for instance, what an erect penis looked like.
One of the victims has a master's degree from the University of Utah and spelled penis, P-E-N-U-S. When she wrote a letter to the medical board. Sex is not one of the most popular subjects in any small town culture, but particularly among the Mormons, it is not talked about. They frown on sex education. They tried to bring sex education to Lovell, and they just ran the guy out of town within about 5 minutes. But also the Baptists and the Lutherans and the Methodists in Lovell, Wyoming, for the most part, did not talk about sex. Dr. Story, when he was a child in Maxwell, Nebraska, a town of 400, did not talk about sex. And I'm not a psychologist, but I think that that sort of sexual repression, I think it makes sex into a glamorous, mysterious, alluring thing that it wouldn't be if they did talk about it and come out in the open. But I'm not really qualified to make that conclusion.
Well, it could also make sex into something rather scary.
And rather weird. And it evidently did in this case.
You had said that others had reported what Dr. Story had done, but there were several women, actually, that went public with this story. Who were these women?
Well, after 20 years of this reign of sexual terror, a woman named Arden MacArthur, a very strong Mormon, head of her relief society in her own Mormon ward, finally had enough. She had been one of Dr. Story's biggest backers. She had been his apologist for years. Women would say, Dr. Story makes me wait for 2 hours in the waiting room, and Arden would say, a good doctor is worth waiting for. Arden would deliver hot cross buns to his house. Arden would do his laundry. As the Mormons do these acts, whether you're Mormon or not, and this was part of her good deeds. She thought Dr. Story was the greatest thing alive, and they would have long talks about religion. He would try to convert her, and she would try to convert him, et cetera, et cetera. One day, her daughter Minda came home and said, Mom, I think Dr. Story did something to me today that he shouldn't have done. Now, understand, these women didn't say things like, Dr. Story raped me, Dr. Story inserted. Uh-uh, that isn't the way that, it's just he did something. He did something, Mom.
And something sexual, though.
Well, that was connoted, but they didn't want to talk about it. Jumping ahead of myself here a little bit, Arden MacArthur did not know what was done to her two daughters until she read my book. She only knew that he had done something. She didn't want to hear about it. So she told Minda in this first instance, Minda, Dr. Story has delivered some of your brothers and sisters. He's delivered your babies. Dr. Story loves you. He saved Dad's life, et cetera, et cetera. Minda goes back home thinking, well, there must be something wrong with me. What is it that makes me think that Dr. Story was inserting himself into me? Then it happened again. And again, Arden said, come on, you're hallucinating, you're imagining things. Then it happened to another daughter of Arden MacArthur. And finally, Arden got it through her head what was happening. And she did a 180-degree flip-flop. She called the medical board. She raised hell with everybody, but still was put off by these people. They didn't want to fool with the town's number one establishment figure. And the medical board said, okay, we'll do it if you bring us five victims.
And she was able to get more than five victims.
After an awful lot of work, because when she started, she thought it's Meg and Minda. That's it. That's key to this whole situation, that each woman thought she was the only victim. It turned out there were women all over town, but they didn't know it. One woman said to me, you want to know who the victims were? Stand outside the Mormon church on Sunday and watch the women coming out. They were the victims, just you know, without hardly any exceptions. But Arden, when she started trying to find the necessary five, the magic number five, didn't know where to start.
How did Dr. Story deny the allegations, which he did?
Well, he denied the allegations totally, and he still does, and his wife does, and his daughters do, and his hardcore supporters do. He's gone through several explanations for how this could have happened. The current one is that the Mormon Church conspired to ruin him because he started his own church, his own competitive church in Lovell, and because he wouldn't convert to the Mormon Church. Now, this flies in the face of all the reality. In the first place, it wasn't all Mormons, although it was primarily. There were Lutheran women. There were he apparently violated quite a few Mexican-American women early in the game who were Catholics. There was a Presbyterian woman. And moreover, when the case broke and it finally became a criminal matter rather than just a license revocation matter, women started checking in from all over the country who had lived in Lovell. One was in Maine, one was in Arizona, one was in Utah, one was in Colorado, getting in touch with the county attorney and saying, yeah, he did it to me 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And then we, little by little began to see the whole picture. I think there were probably 100 to 200 victims. That's a heck of a conspiracy.
I'm speaking with Jack Olson today. His book is called Doc, The Rape of the Town of Lovell. It's published by Athenaeum. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jack Olson is my guest. His book is called Doc. What kind of a witness was Dr. Story on the stand?
He wasn't a very effective witness for himself. people who saw him on 60 Minutes felt the same way, that he's not a very expressive person. He always had difficulty communicating. His patients would misunderstand. And he's very autocratic. His favorite comment to his patients whenever they asked him any kind of question was, "I'm the doctor here." And he controlled everything, which is characteristic of rapists.
The women charged that they had been sexually assaulted. You used the word rape. Now, he denied that this happened, and yet there must be some reason why someone would do this to women. As you look into his past, what would be something that would make someone want to abuse women
like this? If you looked into his past, you'd think you were looking at a Norman Rockwell cover for the old Saturday Evening Post. Little Nebraska town, the Platte River just down the road. What I saw, which seems to me to be common to a lot of these cases, was one very eccentric parent and one very indulgent parent, which is not to say that they were not fine people. You had a father who was, to say the least, odd, and a very lovely mother who was still alive, who wrote three different letters to the judge explaining that her son had to be innocent, who testified for her son. She's now in her 80s, a very lovely person, but quite clearly, her son John can do no wrong.
But an odd parent is not going to make a psychopath.
Nobody knows what makes a psychopath. But I have found in several cases that I've been involved in, the combination of an eccentric parent who sends out eccentric signals. You know, the first signals that we get as little kids are the ones that determine what we're going to be, whether we form a conscience, etc. So the combination of the eccentric parent and the indulgent parents, if your parents approve of everything that you do, you don't develop a conscience either. I mean, we're talking highly theoretical stuff here, but there seems to be a connection.
What kind of messages, though, would his father send out? What kind of eccentric messages?
His father was, for example, would march them in the front yard with wooden rifles in a kind of not a Nazi style, but a kind of an autocratic sort of thing. He also would do odd things, like when the family would go to visit, he would sit out in the car and read the stock market reports. He was entirely involved in the family business, which was a general store in this little town, and just known around town as a very fine man, but an odd duck. His mother, as I say, was just a lovely lady, but John can do no wrong.
You say this is the rape of the town of Lovell, Wyoming. How did he rape the town?
Well, the town is split right down the middle and has been ever since this happened. He raped the town, first of all, by raping the women. Second of all, by using this doctor-patient bonding that takes place where your doctor can do no wrong to accumulate a hardcore of supporters who have moved heaven and earth to get him out of prison. In fact, it took 3 years to put him in prison, because whenever something would happen to him in the courts or the state system, he would bounce back. Everybody would put the yellow ribbons up on his trees and bring the food over, and Doc Story would be back in business. In fact, on one of those occasions, women who wanted to show their respect and admiration for him called in and set up pelvic exams that they didn't need, just to show how much they trusted good old Doc. Well, that's a rape of the mind. I mean, these people were completely confused by what he did, and he abused this doctor-patient thing. There are still people there who will fight you if you have the nerve to say that Dr. Story is guilty. And if you look into their cases, as I did, you find invariably he saved their lives, or he saved Dad's life, or Mom's life. There's the bonding, and that's what's taken place.
I don't want to beat this thing to the ground, but I would think that the rape of a woman is very different than the rape of a town that is, in a way, complicit with what he was doing. And a woman who, for a variety of different reasons, is there sort of prostrate on a table, that's a different kind of,
yes,
of rape.
Well, it's a slight play on words, but I suppose I could have called it the destruction of a town or the violation of a town's trust. But to me, in a way, that's a rape. If you walk up and down the main street of Lovell nowadays, half the stores are boarded up. And the reason is that when this happened, the town split 50-50, and you had to say where you stood. Families were broken up. Husbands and wives were broken up over this. Every single shop or store in town lost half its customers.
I wonder, with things like true crime, and you write true crime stories, whether it isn't rather like the local evening news where you see murder and murders and fires. And you can say to yourself, well, thank God it's not me. I mean, I can sleep well tonight because it happened to somebody else.
Used to be like that. True crime, with the exception of In Cold Blood, which is a whole another four-hour program that we could talk about, with the exception of In Cold Blood, up until a few years ago, true crime books were blood and guts books. And you read them because you liked violence and you liked to read about the man being slammed into the wall with a fist and the blood flying all over. That's changing, and it's been changing markedly over the last two or three years.
In what way, then?
In the way that the reviewers, for example, are insisting that you also give us some help on understanding why did this murderer become a murderer? Why did this rapist become a rapist? It has now reached the point where if you don't do that, and I've been trying to do that for five books now, if you don't do that, you are taken to task by the reviewers, and that's the way it ought to be. These books cannot be justified in terms of getting people off on violence and rape and murder. The concern is, what made this guy do what he did? What can we learn from it? How can we raise our kids better? How can we avoid being victimized by somebody like this? And there's more and more of that in true crime, and I think that's the reason for the explosion of interest in true crime books these days.
I would think, though, that a certain percent of your readers are going to get off on the violence. I mean, and reading, even if it is well-documented, well-researched, and well-written, it's there to, I suppose, in a kind of sensational way.
But with a little bit of luck, they'll learn something. They'll learn something.
I'm curious about how you choose the stories that you do. And obviously, I suppose part of it is looking at headlines. But there are many headlines about many kinds of violent stories. What makes you choose a particular story? And I guess Doc is a good example.
Well, I seem to have this. The book that I'm working on now is another rape book, and I seem to have fallen into the subject of rape, which is fine with me because I think it's a very important subject. And the reason that I think I have fallen into it is that I have now interviewed probably 30 women who have been raped, and I finally have got it through my stupid masculine skull that this is a very, very cruel crime. Half the women that I talk to can't discuss their rape, which may have happened 20 years ago, without crying. And I finally have got it through my head that this is an important and a dreadful and a horrible crime. So I seem to be writing about it.
I'm interested in as you say, your stupid masculine mind, but what ideas did you have about rape?
I think I probably was a little more enlightened than a lot of people. I'm not stupid, but I didn't realize how horrible it was. I wasn't the extreme that you find with some men. Well, she does it every night with her husband. What's the difference? Or the rapist that I'm now writing about, who, among others in his 55 rapes, raped a lot of prostitutes. And he sits there in the penitentiary telling me how he really didn't mean any harm, et cetera. And he says, with the prostitutes, I was just stealing their time. They did it anyway for money, so I was just stealing their time. And I say, Ed, I don't think you quite understand. But he's a psychopath, and he's never going to understand.
You're talking about understanding rape as a kind of violence and not sex.
Exactly. It's only accidentally a sex crime, you know. It's a crime of hatred, which is what Doc Story was doing. He was ventilating his hatred of the Mormon religion by raping their women. And it's a crime of control and a crime of rage. And sex comes last.
Well, thank you, Jack Olson, for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jack Olson's book, Doc, The Rape of the Town of Lovell, is published by Athenaeum. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Amy Willens. Her new book, The Rainy Season, focuses on Haiti since the fall of its repressive dictator, Jean-Claude Duvalier. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. The heroine of Alan Gerganus's upcoming novel is the oldest living Confederate widow, and her recollections of her life and of her husband's span a century and a half of American history. Coming up, we talk with Alan Gerganus. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead introduces us to more new Duke Ellington music. And 20 years ago, television had one of its greatest moments, when the world watched man first walk on the moon. Now television critic David Bianculli has the perfect way to relive that experience. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. The Office of Management and Budget reportedly plans to forecast tomorrow that Congress is on its way to satisfying the $110 billion Graham-Rudman deficit target for the coming fiscal year. A congressional source told the Associated Press that, by the government's updated calculations, the deficit for the 1990 fiscal year would be about $99.5 billion. Graham-Rudman automatically triggers spending cuts on most domestic and defense programs. A second former Housing and Urban Development official has refused to testify before a congressional panel. Hunter Cushing, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Multifamily Housing at HUD, is asserting his Fifth Amendment right. Last month, Deborah Gordine, a former executive assistant to then-Secretary Samuel Pierce, invoked her constitutional right against self-incrimination. Congress is investigating charges of fraud and influence peddling at HUD. Earlier today, U.S. Trade Representative Carla Hills, a former housing secretary during the Ford administration, said she represented clients of her law firm before the agency and in meetings with peers, but she denied asking for special treatment.
I abided by a few basic common sense rules when representing clients before HUD or any other agency. I did not seek any action from a former agency unless I believed that I would grant the same action were I the agency official.
Hills succeeded in getting permission from Pierce for her client to continue underwriting housing project mortgages after questions were raised about the agency's professionals. Drug czar William Bennett and Attorney General Richard Thornburg announced today that more than 400 drug arrests have been made in the past 2 months, mostly in Washington, D.C. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The arrests were part of Operation Stop, an attempt to get career drug criminals off the street. Federal marshals and local police from the District of Columbia and suburban areas in nearby Maryland and Virginia arrested 431 people on drug charges. An additional 25 were arrested on drug-related homicide charges. The sting is part of the Bush administration's effort to use the nation's capital as an example that the war against drugs can be won. Bennett, appearing at today's news conference with federal and local officials, says the success of Operation Stop is proof that the turf battles between them can be surmounted.
Yeah, there's some friction, there was some bumping, there were some things that had to be worked out, but I think as the people at this table will tell you, most of those problems were worked out.
The operation targeted more than 800 suspects. Nearly half are still at large. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down today 1.33 points to 2553.49. Trading was moderate, with about 133 million shares changing hands. Advances outnumbered declines about 8-7. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The long suites that Duke Ellington composed were his most controversial works. Many critics thought they sounded disjointed, no greater than the sum of their parts. But lately, opinion has changed. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is a defender of these works and has a review of a newly issued recording of Ellington's first major suite, Black, Brown, and Beige.
Thank you. When Duke Ellington premiered his suite Black, Brown, and Beige at Carnegie Hall in 1943, critical reaction was mixed. The jazz periodicals were suitably enthusiastic, but a few commentators, like John Hammond, said Ellington had overreached himself. Some critics maintained a jazz musician had no business working with such long forms. It's hard not to interpret that last observation as at least tinged with racism. Ellington should have shrugged it off, but these attacks shook his confidence in the suite. The versions he recorded in 1944 and 58 were abbreviated or otherwise compromised. Until this year, the best version has been available on the Prestige label's three-record set from the concert in January 1943. Now, 15 years after Ellington's death, there's a better version. The final installment in the 10-volume Ellington Private Collection has the ungainly title Studio Sessions, New York and Chicago, 1965, 1966, and 1971. But the first nine of its 11 pieces comprise the best version of Black, Brown, and Beige we have, the one that makes it easiest to hear how the parts fit together and what it all means. Ellington called Black, Brown, and Beige a tone parallel to the history of the American Negro. Like other Ellington suites, it's been dismissed as being too broad and too disjointed, but by design, it refutes the myth of a monolithic Black American culture. Instead, as its title suggests, it reflects the multiplicity of African American experience, its joys and pain, tragic past and hopes for the future, and its secular and religious institutions. The opening movement, Work Song, takes a chant slaves might have used to coordinate their labor and transmutes it into a majestic theme. It's a metaphor for Black Americans' triumph over adversity. Vocal movement from Black, Brown, and Beige, called the blues, shows how ingeniously Ellington could mix different genres. The melody and Tony Watkins' baritone voice are more suited to the church than the barrel house. Ellington shows how the worlds of blues and spirituals intersect and coexist. The piece is not actually a blues, but the expanding lyric captures the elastic nature of blues form. And check out the huge dissonant chords behind Watkins' vocal.
The blues. The blues ain't. The blues ain't nothing. The blues ain't nothing but a cold gray day, and all night long it stays that way. Ain't something that leaves you alone. Ain't nothing you want to call your own. Ain't something with sense enough to get up and go. Ain't nothing like nothing alone.
By knitting together work songs and art music and blues and gospel, Ellington rebels against the artificial categories we all use to divide ourselves from each other. He celebrates cultural diversity and human solidarity at the same time. Black, brown, and beige is the best illustration of what Ellington meant when he said that great art is beyond category.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Volume 10 of Duke Ellington, The Private Collection. It's on the Saja record label, distributed by Atlantic. This is Fresh Air. Alan Gerganis has chosen a 99-year-old war widow, nearly blind and living in a nursing home, to be the voice of his first novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. Lucy Morrison's husband joined the Confederate Army when he was 13, and even though the war ended for the North and South, it was never over for him. Through the bits and pieces of Lucy's memory, we learn the story of their stormy marriage. Alan Gerganis has written for Atlantic, Harper's, Paris Review, and The New Yorker. He teaches writing at Sarah Lawrence College. Gerganis had his own war experiences 100 years after the Civil War. Back in the 60s, he was drafted and signed up with the Navy. While he waited to be shipped off to Vietnam, he spent some time reading in a Long Beach, California library. It was there that he discovered in a 1790 census register that his family in North Carolina had owned slaves.
The 1790 census listed not just the names, but the number of members of the household, black and white, the number of head of livestock, the number of acres owned. And I found, along with my great-great-grandmother and great-grandmother's names and facts, statistics about the slaves that had been owned by my great-grandfather. This had never been mentioned. It was a kind of understood secret. But the idea that my own relatives had participated in slavery in this direct way brought the fact home to me in a way that was extraordinarily disturbing and alarming.
It created a kind of moral dilemma for you, as you write about it. But this was something that happened 100 years ago. I mean, in a sense, you could say that you had nothing to do with it. I mean, it was part of your family's past, but that wasn't you.
That's one way of approaching it, and I think a lot of people, especially in our current age, tend to approach things in precisely that kind of, what seems to me, kind of facile, pleasure-bound, pleasure-determined manner. Maybe the fact of being from the South, with its sense of history, its sense of lineage.
Why was this a family secret? Why was it something, as you say, that everyone knew about but no one talked about?
I think it got to be a habit after the war not to mention having owned slaves in precisely the same way, perhaps, that, and this is again an overstatement, perhaps, but I doubt it, the way Germans don't mention Uncle Fritz being the head of the local SS. I mean, you say he had a distinguished military career, and you say, we were terribly good to all the people who worked for us. We don't say all the people we owned. So one of my ambitions for the book was to incorporate these lives that had been tacitly involved in my life, but in fact left off the record.
Do you think that family secrets and what families don't say is actually more important than what is said? That somehow what is withheld is really what's important?
I think one of the things that sort of fascinates me most about fiction and about life is how none of us can really keep a secret.
And yet none of us really tell all.
That's right. Absolutely. It's a curious paradox that the more you want to hide something, the more apparent it becomes to anybody who's willing to notice. So that the issue of secrecy is curious in a town such as the one I grew up in, which was 65% black. And yet that major proportion of the population had very little control or visibility. There was not a society page in the local paper that allowed a black bride or groom to appear. So that it was as if 65% of the town were, in fact, a kind of shadow world, mm-hmm. a kind of invisible parallel world that was summoned only when you needed a floor cleaned or only when something needed doing in the yard that was much too difficult for oneself.
You say that guilt is a flat-footed emotion and not worthy of being written about. What emotions are worth writing about and worth writing about when it comes to a situation like this or when we look back into our past and we see slavery and other things that we might be ashamed of?
That's a wonderful question. It's a novel of a question, in fact. The whole scheme is there. I'm sounding very sententious talking about my first memory. I'm 41 years old. It's not as if I'm some 99-year-old war widow who's allowed to tell these things, but you did ask.
That will come later.
That'll happen. My first memory of another human being is of a black woman holding me in her arms. And most of my very early infant memories are of black people being nice to me, probably changing my diapers, but more specifically rocking me in a rocking chair, which I now have in my grungy New York apartment and sit and rock in, hoping to reconstitute some of the early comfort. They were models for me, these people in the foreground with white parents peeking over their shoulders periodically, for what one human being could give another in terms of comfort and safety. So that was the beginning. The guilt is something that comes later. And finally, I think there's an adult attempt to reconcile the two elements, to have the ambition, which is an enormous one, an enormously difficult one to implement between black Americans and white Americans, to honor each other, to see each other, to admit to the difficulty of both sides of the struggle, and not to affix blame only, but to understand that it's a human arrangement as well as an economic necessity that brought us together, and that we have to make concessions and we have to learn to live together. And in some ways, we have to honor each other's mythology. And I think one thing that we writers can do is, by telling the truth, bump up against the possibility of a new kind of mythology.
And I suppose telling the truth, whatever that is, or however you get to the truth, has to do with memory and remembering. But as we all know, memory is subjective, it's selective. It usually is there to serve us and to make some truth about how we live now. And this, in part, is what your book is about as well, is how we do and don't remember and what the difference is, I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one wants, in a tour guide and a witness, one wants somebody who is not just following the script that the DAR has approved for all docents who show people through the big house of American history. Yeah. One wants somebody who is able to say, Thomas Jefferson quite probably had a black slave mistress and had children by her, and this is the door through which she entered his bedroom at Monticello. I remember as a kid being taken through Monticello on a tour. I was a firebrand little snotty 14-year-old who'd read this fact about Mr. Jefferson, who remains one of the most admirable and dimensional people that I've ever read about. And I said to the High Church Episcopal Club lady who was showing people through Monticello on alternate Tuesdays, is that the door the slave mistress came through?
In your loudest voice.
That's right. With my parents standing directly beside me, and then even more distant from me as they tried to eliminate themselves from any contact with me, the club lady gave one look at me and said, "In the next room, we will see the music stand that Mr. Jefferson designed for his daughter."
That's what happens to history, isn't it?
That's right.
We kind of plaster over
it. Absolutely. So my fantasy was, How about if we find a person who has been left out of American history in the record book way, but who, in her watchfulness and in her detachment and in the very fact that she's ignored and is just a silent watcher in the corner, has in fact seen more of it in a more dimensional and balanced way than any of the noted, footnoted participants in so-called history actually have been.
Why did you choose the voice of a 99-year-old woman to tell this story?
The advent of the novel in some ways involved getting a flash, an image of a killing at a watering hole, partly based on the Thomas Aiken's watering hole painting of the gentleman and the dog all swimming together amicably. I don't quite understand how that very peaceable picture could become an image of war, but that's in fact what happened. It's a voice of a woman who is funny and detached, completely passionate, completely involved because she's been completely left out and has chosen to be completely involved. A widow, a mother of nine, a resident of a small town. And it seemed to me the perfect witness for these cataclysmic events, which, as I try to suggest in the book, and which everybody knows who's thought about it for a second, are in fact very small town, small time, domestic and human events.
She says at the very end, "Well, I've told you all, or most, or some of what I had to say."
Exactly.
Do you think that she withheld and that we withhold stuff just because we need it for ourselves?
I think so. I think secrets are enormously important. And as we said earlier, the secrets you think you're keeping are frequently the ones that are public knowledge. And the ones that you think are public knowledge are in fact your secrets. It's the way all of us in some ways want to be loved for the person we aren't. I mean, how many times have you heard a great beauty say, "I'm so intelligent and nobody recognizes it"? And how many times have you heard somebody who's brilliant say, "If I had long legs and blonde hair, I would be the happiest person in the world"? It's all about opposites meeting perpetually.
Well, I can't tell you what a pleasure it was for me to talk with you today, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it enormously.
Alan Gurganus's first novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, will be published by Knopf in September. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us what news they're covering. Noah, what do you have for us?
Hi, Marty. The B-2 stealth bomber flew successfully out of Edwards Air Force Base in California today. The aircraft cost $500 million. Lots of concern in Congress, though, about future funding. Tomorrow in Kenya, the government there is going to burn millions of dollars worth of ivory in protest of ivory poaching all over Africa. Also tonight, we'll catch up with the Tour de France, the bicycle race that will finish its more than 2,000-mile course coming up on Sunday with the final leg of time trial from Versailles to Paris. The American Greg LeMond, who won in 86, who had a hunting accident, is back and riding strong in this year's Tour de France.
Okay, Noah, thanks. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The last time our country was brought together in front of the television to follow events in space was after the Challenger disaster. This week, TV returns to a more optimistic time in the space program, when man first walked on the moon. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of one of the commemorative programs.
T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4. 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
There was nothing like it. If you had to rank the most important TV events of all time, the Apollo 11 mission would have to be number one, above the Kennedy assassination, above anything else ever televised. An estimated 600 million Earthlings watched on July 20th, 1969, as Neil Armstrong took that first giant leap for mankind. In celebration of the event's 20th anniversary, TV is sprinkling moon dust everywhere you look. CBS presented a primetime special last week, and just about every network this side of the Weather Channel is planning some sort of moon landing special or anniversary report this week. But if you're going to watch only one, it should be the one on the Arts and Entertainment Network. A&E is commemorating the moonwalk the same way it commemorated the 25th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy, by presenting unedited real-time coverage of NBC's news reports at the time. The show begins this Thursday at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time, when Edwin Newman introduces this newest As It Happens special. Watch again, or for the first time, as Neil Armstrong stands on the ladder of the lunar module, waits until Mission Control turns on the TV camera, then descends to the sandy surface of the moon.
Houston, this Neil, radio check.
Neil, this is Houston, loud and clear. Break, break, buzz, this is Houston. Radio check and verify TV circuit breaker in.
Roger, TV circuit breaker's in. Space pipe clear.
And we're getting a picture on the TV. Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
10:56 p.m. Eastern Time.
It really is remarkable to see it all again, to sit there and remember what it was like to be amazed and afraid by what TV was showing us. The pictures were astoundingly clear, the sound amazingly crisp. And when you watch those guys hopping down off the ladder, then jumping back up in the less powerful lunar gravity, it was like watching a science fiction movie. Only this was different. This was science fact. It was an internationally shared TV event that made the idea of a global village a reality. Everyone watched. Well, only one out of every six people on the planet actually watched, but everyone I knew was watching. It seemed at the time to remind everyone of how beautiful and fragile our planet was, and how, from the perspective of space, we were all in this together. It's something we may have forgotten since, but watching the moonwalk coverage 20 years later brings it all back home.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for listening. Here's more from the flight of Apollo 11.
Yes, we see it. We see it. Here it is. Apollo 11 coming right down towards the primary coverage. It isn't red anymore because the skies are that light, momentarily behind a puffy gray cloud, but it's there.
Apollo 11 should be on main chutes now.
And the flight of Apollo 11 is over. The men are on the ocean.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Hades and Souvaye, journalist Amy Willens tells us how recent events have changed that country and how covering the story has changed her. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles blues star Bobby Bland, and John Lennon reviews the new novel from the author of Gorky Park. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. That and more next time on Fresh Air.